You're listening to the Musical Ecology's Radio Hour. I'm your host, Dan Joseph, and once a month we bring you a mix of conversations and musical selections by artists featured on the Musical Ecology series in Park Slope, Brooklyn. I invite you to visit our website for more information on our artists and upcoming events at musicalecologies.net. For tonight's program, we'll revisit our event on Thursday, November 10th, with Los Angeles-based pianist Vicky Ray. A leading interpreter of contemporary piano music, Ray is known for thoughtful and innovative programming, which seeks to redefine the piano recital in the 21st century. Making a rare New York appearance, Ray performed a one-hour program that explored different approaches to the short form, with works by John Cage, Joseph Pereira, George Kurtog, and Chinnery Ung. But we began the evening with a conversation about her performing and teaching career and some of her recent projects. Let's listen now to my conversation with pianist Vicky Ray at the Old Stone House in Park Slope, Brooklyn. So, welcome, and it's really a thrill to have you here, of course. And I should say that, you know, we're Vicky and I are already acquainted. Vicky was my teacher, a piano teacher at CalArts years ago, and
and he still likes me. It's
kind of a reunion of sorts. So it's great to have you here, and I guess you know, it's a good timing that we could have you. And so maybe that's a good place to start. We just kind of talk a little bit about CalArts and the West Coast, and so I guess, you know, how are things at CalArts? You know, I haven't been out there much lately, but
wow, I'm always a little flummoxed. There's some old CalArtsians here.
Great.
And how to respond when people ask me that? I mean, it's still an amazing place of experimentation and risk taking, and it's still, you know, an art school run by artists, so it's by turns inspiring and completely frustrating. You know, I've been there 25 years, my 25th year,
right.
And I can't imagine being anywhere else. You know, like, I can't imagine being at a school where they call me Dr. Ray and I have to wear high heels to school. Like, I just couldn't do that.
Right.
I love walking into the, you remember the main gallery, the whole school is built around this big open main gallery, and you walk in the morning and there's a Tai Chi class practicing or a dance class, and there's crazy beautiful artwork on the walls, and somebody's practicing tabla, you know, that's where I get to go to work every day. So yeah, it's pretty great. And the one an exciting thing that's been going on in School of Music is that we started a new doctoral program about 8 years ago now called Performer Composer. And it was the first one of its kind in the country, and the response has been amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And we're considering trying to kind of focus the whole music school that way. And the reason that I think it's so exciting is because I think that it shows a kind of a move back to a more well-rounded model of what a musician used to be, like, in,
right.
You know, in the 19th century, when musicians, all musicians were composers and improvisers,
mm-hmm.
as well as performing on their instruments, you know. And then we got so specialized, and the whole era of the virtuoso, and then the modern music specialist, and the Baroque specialist, and, oh, I'm only an improviser, and I'm only a composer. And I see us now finally starting to move away and come back to this sort of, you know,
right.
musician as a whole artist. And I think our school is really kind of on the forefront of that, so it's exciting.
Oh, that is exciting. So that's just a doctoral program at this point, or it's
at this point, but I think very soon it could be. I don't want to get in trouble with my dean by saying too much, but I think it could be that everyone who comes to our school will
right.
be under that umbrella.
Right.
And since I've been changing too as an artist, I've been composing more and improvising more in the last decade of my life.
Mm-hmm.
I find that I'm integrating that more into my teaching, and it's more exciting for me. You know, I still love teaching Mozart sonatas, but it's really fun to work with someone on their composition and do some improvising together. You know,
mm-hmm,
also.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. Yeah, well, that certainly, it seems more broadly in the musical world, as it were, that this trend is getting more accentuated. I mean, the idea of people being more composer-performers or just a more holistic, integrated kind of musical practice.
Yep.
So it's great that CalArts is on the vanguard there.
And is it
a big, pretty big program at this point? I mean, how many enrollees do we have in the doctoral program?
No, we only accept 2 a year.
Oh, okay.
So it's been really competitive and really interesting, and a very international bunch that we've accepted over the last few years. So I currently have 2 doctoral students working with me. One is from Australia and the other is from Brazil. And they're both genius, brilliant musicians. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. Keeps me on my toes.
Well, that's great to hear. So in addition to mostly being out at CalArts, you're also, for some years now in the summer, you've been coming east for the Summer Institute of Bang & McCann, right? How many years have you been doing that?
I don't know exactly.
5, 10?
8.
8 years?
Do you know Bruce? Do you remember when I first... Yeah? Nah. 8 or 9. Lisa Moore used to be the pianist in the group, and then the summer she left the band, Michael Gordon was out at CalArts doing an opera with us, with Richard Foreman, What to Wear, and Michael and I knew each other, but not well, and then so we worked together on that opera. And then that summer, they needed a pianist, and so they invited me to come out, and I've been going every summer since, and it's like they're like my family now. And I get, it's great to hang out at Massmocha for 3 weeks. It's nonstop new music for 3 weeks. I go home with so many ideas. It takes me about a year to kind of process through everything, and then I go back and get fed some more. So
Right. It's
great.
So is there much dialogue between, or many students coming between the two, or is that...
Between CalArts and Bang & McCann?
Yeah, I mean, not so much.
There's been a little bit, but there's still that strange wall that goes up right around...
The Rockies or something?
Yeah. I'm always amazed when I'm there. Like, they'll say, where do you teach? And I'll say, CalArts, and they'll say...
Where's that? Well, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. I'm always, as someone who has, lived on both coasts, certainly. I mean, I'm from the East Coast and most of my life here, but I did spend 10 years in California, and really for me, I guess I feel like I really found my artistic self there. But so there's a lot I appreciate about it, but you're from the West, right? Or do you, am I right about that? I mean maybe
Montana.
Not the West Coast, but that's still west of the Rockies, right?
Yeah. Right in the Rockies.
The open spaces of So I mean, how do you, how is your identity or your feeling for the West versus the East, or I don't know how to talk about it, but obviously there is a divide, as you say, and there are different qualities certainly, and I'm always interested in how people perceive it on both sides of the of that. Duality, I guess, but I don't know.
That's a big, hard, gnarly, complex question.
Right.
And a couple things come to mind, just maybe as tiny examples, rather than try to address it in a big way.
Sure.
But in September, September, I guess it was, I came over here to play with Ensemble Signal, one of the many Reich 80th birthday concerts at Miller Theater, And I was just thinking about how differently they play Reich, if they're an example of East Coast minimalism, as opposed to all the Reich I've played in L.A. And I guess I would just have to say, for the musicians in the house, that it seemed like people in New York play really on the front side of the beat, and people in L.A. play a little bit on the back side. The beat's still there, but it's just sort of, yeah. But I don't know, we were walking over here today talking about the quality of light and I don't know. I think the differences are not quite as stark as they used to be.
And
there's been so much cross-pollination. We have a lot of Brooklyn composers who are living in LA now.
Really?
So I think those lines are really blurring and sort of dissolving.
I think that's true. But there is I still feel, I mean, speaking of the light and the landscape and, the air even is just still very different in California, speaking of it. And there's something about that has some resonance, imparts itself on the music and but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could say because it's warm and pleasant year-round that we're all laid back. But, I mean, every musician I know is stressed out of their minds and working like crazy. And, Yeah, they were just, we just get to go out in the backyard and barbecue at the end of the day, that's all.
Right.
You know? Right. I'll get back to you on that. I'll think about
okay.
it.
Okay, well, it's just an ongoing topic here in our conversations because so many, there's, you know, there's so much of that back and forth. But
I mean,
and it's a personal thing for me as well, having been living in both places. It's a question I'm always thinking about. So.
I mean, in the old days, the lines were really clear because, you know, a lot more, like, really hardcore uptown music was going on the East Coast, and the West Coast had Lou Harrison, and like we weren't afraid to write pretty music
right.
on the left coast, you know. But I think that's all really, really old news. I think it's, and especially with the advent of the internet and social media, I think things are just much more permeable now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So. Okay, well, fair enough.
Well, no, three of the pieces I'm playing today were written by West Coast composers, so. You guys can tell me if they...
Right.
Yeah.
Right, well, let's talk about the program a little bit, because I think it bears a little, you know, it's worth exploring a little bit. So, I mean, I think a lot of us know Cage and his prepared piano music, which is, you know, it's exciting that we have an opportunity to actually hear that. I mean, that's pretty unusual to hear, you know, to get the piano all prepared. But that's one of the earliest pieces, is it not, of the Perilous Night?
Yeah, it was his first really large-scale work for prepared piano. He'd written a bunch of smaller pieces.
Right.
But he wrote this in 1944, and it was right when he and Xenia, his wife, were breaking up. And it's based loosely on this myth, this Irish myth about a warrior who has to sleep before battle on this bed that's on a floor of polished jasper, so it's very tenuous and scary. I can't find anything else out about the myth, so if anyone knows anything about the Perilous Night myth, I'd love to hear more about it. But he said that this is one of his like most emotional pieces, and it was not well received, which really wounded him. But he said that the piece is about the loneliness and terror that comes to one when love becomes unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, for Cage, that's a pretty... you know, emotional introduction
sure.
to one of his pieces.
No doubt.
Yeah,
no
so
doubt.
It's in these six really beautiful, tiny little movements, each one like a very different sound world.
Mm-hmm. And well, and that's kind of the theme of your program tonight, the miniatures. So I guess that's a good starting point to the program to have six parts, little tiny pieces. And
I mean, these pieces actually aren't miniature at all. Some of them are quite vast, like the Chin Ryung piece is 20 minutes long, but it's made up of these beautiful, tiny little mosaics that, I mean, each one of these movements could stand by themselves as a piece,
mm-hmm.
But you put them all together and they form larger, you know, pictures.
Right, and that's seven mirrors by Chin Ryung.
Yeah.
Great. And well, tell us about the Joseph Pereira, the California, an LA composer.
Well, he's originally from New York, right, Pereira?
Yes,
the Pereira clan is here. Yes. And played percussion with the New York Phil, and then we nabbed him in LA, and he's our principal timpanist with the LA Phil. But he's also having a very, very successful, vibrant career as a composer and a conductor.
Nice.
We just did Ballet Mécanique together. Disney, and he conducted. It was fantastic.
With the Philharmonic?
Four pianos, 13 percussion, and the film by Léger, which was fantastic. And Joe conducted, and it was really exciting.
Wow.
But he and I have been kind of new music buddies, and I asked him to write a piece, and which he graciously agreed to do. And he was going to the Norton Simon with his little girl, and he always usually just makes a beeline for the Modern collection. But he stopped in the Baroque collection, and he got completely waylaid and spent the day there and was just kind of gobsmacked by these five paintings and went back time and time again and decided to write these pieces, which are not at all Baroque in any way, about these Baroque paintings. And luckily, the Norton Simon sent us the images, so we'll be projecting those while I play. But the pieces certainly stand alone as... as pieces, and I think they're. I don't think I'll need to say anything more about them. I think you'll find. I mean, yeah.
Excellent. And
if the relationship to the music to the painting doesn't seems obscure after I play, I'd love to talk to you about it afterwards and see what everyone thinks.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And so I guess this is maybe a New York premiere of this collection?
I think you're
collection.
Right. Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent.
Yeah, they're wonderful pieces.
Great. And then a set of pieces by Kurtar, right? Tell us about those a little bit.
Well, I thought you couldn't have a concert about miniatures without including Kurtar, because he's been writing these Yatakuk for, well, I think he started them in 1973. Mm-hmm. And he's written like 8 volumes of them now, and he keeps adding to them. And mm-hmm. they started off as sort of pedagogical pieces, very whimsical. He just wanted kids to just make sounds on the piano and have fun and not get all caught up in learning to read rhythms and notes. So it was about just making sounds at first. But they sort of have gradually evolved, and he keeps adding to them. And many of them are just, some of them are just 2 lines long. Most of them are just a page. And many of them are homages to friends of his. Some of them are very tongue-in-cheek. Some of them are piano forehands, because he concertizes a lot with his wife, Marta. But I just picked some of my favorites. I thought they would be kind of little, nice little palate cleansers mm-hmm. between the Pereira and the Ung.
Right. So this is your own subset.
Yes.
And it's drawn from different periods,
different volumes. Yeah.
Nice.
Well, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So your greatest hits or something along
there. Some.
Certainly some favorites.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. I look forward to hearing all this stuff.
Yeah.
Well, great. Well. Well, before we get to that, though, I guess you're also a kind of a presenter as well. Am I mistaken? I mean, you're involved in a series as well, right?
Oh, you mean Pianospheres?
Pianospheres, yeah.
Yeah. So
how does that work?
Well, Leonard Stein, who was Arnold Schoenberg's assistant for many, many years at UCLA and at USC.
I remember Leonard Stein.
Of course you do.
He would come periodically for lectures and stuff. He wasn't teaching formally at the Institute at that time, but he was around. Yeah.
I forgot you were there then.
Yeah.
He invited me and 4 of my colleagues to start a piano series that was devoted to the less familiar realms of the piano repertoire, which basically turned into a contemporary piano series. And we all said yes, because we were completely honored that Leonard would ask us, and sort of terrified, because we were all just out of school. And it just kept going, and it kept growing. Mm-hmm. And I think this is our 23rd season.
Oh, my goodness.
And yeah, and at first we were completely self-produced and, you know, stuffing envelopes and all that. But mm-hmm. now we have a lovely board, and we have a great venue. We've been able to bring in wonderful guest artists. Mm-hmm. And now we have a satellite series where we're featuring the next generation of upcoming young pianists who specialize in contemporary music.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of passing the torch.
Nice.
We've been able to commission many, many new works for the instrument. And
mm-hmm.
it's been a really great legacy that he left us. And actually, in a couple weeks, it would have been his 100th birthday. So we're dedicating this season to him.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, where does it happen again?
Well, we're at Red Cat now.
Well,
we used
Red
to be
Cat.
At Zipper,
okay.
But we're at, which is the Roy and Edna Disney CalArts Theater, which is in Disney Hall, that belongs to CalArts, but they also present
mm-hmm.
other things. We moved there because we wanted to be able to do stuff more easily with video and electronics, and that space is better suited for it.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Well,
yeah.
I hope to catch one of those next time. What does it run? Is it fall and spring kind of series?
Yeah, sort of, yeah, pretty much.
And monthly, or a couple times a season? Or?
It's kind of every month, every other month. It's
mm-hmm.
hard, you know, whenever they allow us, they give us a date, you know.
I see.
Yeah, we're at their whimsy a little bit.
The Red Cat.
Yeah.
I see. Well, it's a busy place.
Yeah.
Well, great. So you're in town to perform at the Old Stone House, but you're also here recording, is that right? So
yeah.
So what are you working on, or what will you be recording?
Well, that first summer at Bang & McCann, this lovely composer came up to me and introduced himself, and it was Bruce Reiprich, who also happens to be here. And he has a summer home in Massachusetts, but he teaches at Flagstaff at Northern Arizona University.
Nice.
And we became friends, and he sent me some of his music, and I completely fell in love with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been playing his pieces ever since then. He wrote an amazing concerto for me that I premiered a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So he's doing a CD of some of his work, and I'm recording a few piano pieces tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow morning. Good.
Yeah, can't drink too much wine tonight.
We won't have much left, don't
okay.
we? Well, that's exciting. So, yeah. Who will it be appearing on a label, or
do we know yet? We don't know it.
We'll
keep you posted on that.
Well, that's great. Well, good. Well, this
check
will be,
out his music.
This will be good. It's Bruce. What's Bruce? Tell us your last name.
Rich. Rich. I don't even say it right. I've known him all these years.
Excellent. Well, yeah. Good.
Yeah.
So what else is coming up in the future? I guess. What awaits you back out in LA? Anything apart from teaching? Any notable concerts coming up or recordings?
Yeah, I have. You know, I do a lot of different kinds of things. So, like December is El Nino by John Adams. That'll be a lovely way to spend the holiday season.
This is an orchestral work.
Yeah.
So you're also playing and doing some concerts in other ensembles, obviously.
Yeah.
The Philharmonic.
I play a lot of piano for the Phil when they do new music stuff. But
right.
Joanne Pierce Martin is the principal keyboardist, but I do a lot of that. And then in January, I have my Piano Spheres concert, which is I'm playing a lot of new chamber music that was written for me. Dylan Mattingly, a wonderful composer out here.
Mm-hmm.
Brad Lovelin, who conducts Ensemble Signal.
Mm-hmm.
A group of new pieces by the Bang & Can founders, Julie, Michael, and David.
This is all on this January Piano Spheres program?
Yeah.
Wow.
And
a big concert.
And a piece for prepared piano and percussion quartet by Eric Griswold, this really great Australian composer who does amazing stuff for prepared piano. But the thing I'm most excited about is a new recording that's going to come out of improvisation, a session of improvisations I did with a slide guitar player who I've happened to know my whole life because he's my little brother.
Oh.
And he's an amazing, amazing musician. And we've wanted to do a project together our whole lives.
Uh-huh.
And finally, we rented a studio and we went and recorded for 2 days. And at the end of it, we were both really happy and really excited about what came out of it.
Nice.
So that's going to come out on Orenda Records, which is a label that does a lot of really interesting improvisation projects.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're hoping to do a lot of touring as a duo.
Nice. Piano and slide guitar.
Yeah, it's like he does amazing stuff with like effects pedals, looping. He has all these crazy slide guitars from all over the world, Indian slide guitars with sympathetic strings. And, and I do a lot of prepared piano stuff and like extended vocal techniques, believe it or not. it gets pretty wacky.
Yeah. And it's all improvised?
I mean, we have some basic structures sometimes we work with if we feel like it. We also, Scott does a lot of video work, so we sometimes improvise with video too.
And what do you call yourself? Just your names?
So far, although we're taking suggestions, but we think we might be called Yar.
Yar.
Yeah.
Okay. Does that mean something to the audience here? Yar?
Yar is actually a word.
It is.
It means you probably know that word, right? It's a sailing term, I think.
Term.
It means Yar. She was Yar. Yeah. She means fleet and energized.
Catherine Hepburn would be the best version.
What?
Catherine Hepburn,
yeah, Philadelphia story. But it's also our name backwards.
Ray, of course. Duh. Well, that's exciting. Well, I look forward to hearing that. Well, so that's a kind of a new, at least a, it sounds like it's a new part of your life, the more the improvising, composing.
I've always done it.
Right.
Like, I did it a lot in the ear unit. I was in the California ear unit for almost 2 decades, and we did a lot of improvising.
Sure.
You know, so, but it was always in a group setting,
right.
You know, and composing too. You know, we all would compose a little bit for the group, but now I'm composing just because I want to. And it just feels like that time of life for me where this is the next thing. I've played so much music by other people and I have some ideas now and I want to try them. I mean, what do
Definitely.
I have to lose? You know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm
Thanks.
Glad to know about that.
Thanks.
And I look forward to hearing it. Well, that's wonderful. I don't want to talk you out here.
I just want to tell you a little bit about the one.
Oh, please.
Yeah. Let's talk. Chinnery Young, if you don't know his music, is a Cambodian composer who came here in the 60s to study clarinet, but ended up being an amazing composer. Studied with Chow Wen Chung and Mario Davidovsky and was the first American composer to win the Grawemeyer. But Chinnery is a really, his music is this very interesting, rich, strange combination of like Cambodian modes and modernism. And I always kind of thought I understood it. But this summer, Chinnery invited some of us to go to Cambodia with him to do a composer's workshop there. And it really just completely changed the way I play his music because we spent a lot of time at Angkor Wat and going to the temples. And there, every single inch of the temples is covered in carvings. Like every inch is telling a story. And Chinnery's music is very much this way. It's full of all kinds of figuration, which I used to think of as being sort of decorative or filigree. But once I saw those temples, none of it was merely decorative. It was all powerfully lyrical and evocative and part of the story. And so when I came back to his music after that, it just refocused it and also just kind of became more physical. It was in my body more after walking those temples. And it was just a really interesting experience to go to his country and
Well, this is the thing that happens. I've noticed that I've had that experience in different ways. I mean, certainly going to a place gives you a broader sense of what the voice is. But this sounds even more elaborate in that you could see what the rich details that were
totally.
Well, that's great. Yeah. So you, how long have you been playing this work, this Seven Mirrors work?
Well, I first learned it, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, but I just played it once. So I got it back up for the summer, and I've been playing it a few times since then. Mm-hmm. And I just have to tell you a quick story. You know, you all hear about like how competitive and nasty, you know, the classical music world can be and the piano world can be. But I have to say, you know, my piano colleagues over the course of my life have been some of the most generous and supportive, helpful people in the world. And when I was in Cambodia, right before I was going to play it, one of the pages of my score just disappeared. And I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? And so I emailed Kathy.
Okay.
Because she's one of the people, she's one of the dedicatees of this piece. And I knew she'd have a copy. And like within, like by the, well before I had to play it, she had like scanned like two different versions of it, and I'm like, oh, but could I have it like this? And she's like, sure, no problem. And she scanned it again, and anyway, she saved me.
That's great.
That is technology.
Right. So when I play that page, it's for you, darling.
And that was my conversation with pianist Vicky Ray on Thursday, November 10th, 2016. The evening continued with a one-hour solo concert performed on our modest Yamaha Baby Grand, and will continue with an excerpt from Chinnery Ung's 1997 composition, Seven Winds. Here now is Vicky Ray performing live at the Old Stone House in Park Slope, Brooklyn. Thank you. And that was Vicky Ray performing three movements from Chinnery Ung's Seven Winds. We heard A Window in the Sky, Dotted Path, and Roar, Lion of the Heart, in that order. We'll continue now with the complete five Baroque settings from the Norton Simon by composer Joseph Pereira, which was also performed that night. Here again is Vicky Ray, live at the Old Stone House in Park Slope, Brooklyn. Thank you. And that was all five of the movements from Joseph Pereira's 2004 composition, Five Baroque Settings from the Norton Simon, performed by Vicky Ray. We'll conclude tonight's program with an excerpt from her performance of John Cage's The Perilous Night for prepared piano, live at the Old Stone House in Park Slope, Brooklyn. You've been listening to the Musical Ecologies Radio Hour. For more information, visit our website at musicalecologies.net.